Hello, I'm Jack Jay.
Hi, Jack.
And this is an honor, an extreme honor. And they talk about miracles in program. This, take my word for it, is a miracle. And I'm very grateful. I'll identify first. Both my parents were alcoholics. The primary alcoholic was my mother. She became an alcoholic when I was about 7. My father, the way I look at it, is he couldn't beat her, so he joined her when I was approximately 14 years old. Now, the dynamics in the family is that my father was Mexican and my mother was Scotch-Irish. And back in that day, that was not necessarily the norm or what was accepted. And she was, no, her religion was anything that her current friend at the bar was. And my father was Catholic. So there's a little conflict there. Now, the way it went down is I was the second of 4 boys. I was my mother's chosen child. And by that, and I don't know people that are familiar with emotional incest, when a parent can't have a relationship with their spouse, they will pick a child. And that child is the one that that becomes their significant other. And I was that for my mother. I knew from I was probably 3 or 4 that I knew that I needed to protect my mother. And she was probably one of the most, a lady that needed the least protection that I've ever met. Now, I was raised at a time when, and I'm going to really age myself here, with Father Knows Best and the Donna Reed Show. And it took a lot of energy to make my mother into one of those mothers. She was raised in a very rough neighborhood. She was not only the member of a gang, she was the leader of the gang. My mother had HP tattooed on her hands for Huntington Park and had little dots. She didn't have it done, she did it herself. So we're not talking a real low-key Donna Reed type mother. And it was not unusual for her to get in a fist fight with one of the neighbors. Again, not a real calm lady. And she really was one of those people that when she started drinking, she changed a lot. She set records at work. She was a very mechanical lady. And she was a machinist when, again, it wasn't typical for women to do that kind of work. She had worked Monday through Friday, set records, and then you would not see her until Sunday morning when the bars closed. And so my mom changed a lot when she got drunk. Her anger, she was a very violent person, had a lot of self-pity, would cry while she wasn't throwing knives. You know, it kind of fluctuated. Now, I remember growing up as a small child, I was so consumed. I was a great Al-Anon right from the beginning. I was a family enabler. I knew exactly what everybody needed in a room. I could work a room and tell you exactly where the tension was, exactly who needed what, and how to keep the bomb from exploding. What I didn't learn is how to take care of myself and what my needs were. It was never asked. They couldn't give less what my needs were. I remember coming home one time from school when I was older and doing pretty well in school, and the kids on the bus would say, "Oh my God, I'm going to get killed." Well, I knew I would catch hell because I'd have to go in my mother's room after she had been drinking all night, wake her up to sign my report card. And I'd get hell for waking her up. Now, I had A's and B's. That didn't mean anything. Again, that's the environment that I was in. But when I was real young, in about the first through fourth grade, I just got pushed through what schools did. Just push them on. Don't keep them back. Because I really could not concentrate on what was going on in the classroom because I was more worried about what was going on at home. And I had a friend that her mother used to read us stories in the morning before we went to school. So she's one night, very polite, said, "Would you like to read?" Well, her daughter was a very good reader. To be polite again, she said, "Jack, would you like to read?" And when I started reading, I probably got A and the, if I was lucky. Well, this friend of mine, again, and not a real easygoing person, said, "If he can't read, I'm not going to listen to him," and stormed off. I was totally humiliated, and her mother was. So the next day, I went to the school library, got a book, read that book, got another book, read that book, and taught myself how to read. And I'd always thought I was stupid, because I was told I was stupid at home. And when I learned to do well in school, that was my mecca. A lot of people said they hated school. I loved school. Nobody was throwing knives. Nobody was doing wild, crazy things. It was all pretty controlled. I liked it. Now, went through school, was doing fairly well. I remember this next one as if it was branded into my soul. I was washing dishes one night, and my mom walked up to me and said, "I need to talk to you. I'm not just putting weight on. I'm pregnant, and I'm pregnant by somebody else." And I knew that my mother had been promiscuous and that I had been meeting her boyfriend since I was 7, 8 years old. And my parents still were together. And they were going to get a divorce and didn't. They ended up staying together. My father raised my youngest brother, who was, I was 14 when he was born. And I really put that date as when I lost all innocence as a child. Because you can try to make something into something else, but when it's that much in your face, that's reality. And you have to deal with it. And that's when my father became an alcoholic. I also remember my dad loved the track. Loved to listen at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to the races. And however that went was how your evening went. If he won, it was okay. If he lost, you got the shit kicked out of you. And since I was my mother's chosen child, I was his rival. So he hated me with a seething passion, and he blamed me for most everything. My brother's not so much, but it came to me. And we were very responsible for taking care of my youngest brother because my mother went to work, worked swing shift, and said, "I don't want to be bothered with all this." So me and my older brother pretty much raised my younger brother. Well, as I'm growing up and hit puberty, I meet my first love. And I refer to her as Runaround Sue. For all the obvious reasons. And you couldn't possibly guess who she was like. I was always attracted to the women that walked through the door that everybody noticed. Very alcoholic, loud, outgoing women. Exactly like my mom. Well, I dated Sue, and of course, what kind of family did Sue come from? An alcoholic, narcotic addicted family, crazy as bed bugs. Man, I was home, it was perfect fit. I was gonna take care of her. Well, we dated for about 3 years. And in that 3 years, when she tried to commit suicide, I remember being at work and saying, "Oh, well, I took an overdose." "Well, okay, I'll come home." Walked up to her mom, and I didn't want to cause any trouble, so I said, "Well, I really need to tell you something. We really need to get Sue ready to take her to the hospital." And she said, "What are you talking about?" "Well, she's kind of taken an overdose." I said, "Okay, then." So we got her to the hospital, took care of that. And I was working about this time, and I had horses. And she said, "I want to go to this rodeo." I said, "That's fine. I had to work Saturday night. I can't go." She took my horse, my saddle. I gave her money. She slept with another guy that night. I come to the rodeo the next night, and she barely even paid attention to me. And I had a few issues with anger, So we had this big scream out in the middle of this 500 people calling each other really sweet names. And I remember going home and waking up the next morning wrapped around a toilet because I had got so drunk that I had to use the toilet and I was wrapped around it when I woke up in the morning. Now we had our ups and downs again there. Of course I forgave her. Of course if I'm a nice guy, she will realize it someday and she'll come back to me. So she had hooked up with this guy and I used to iron her clothing so she could go spend the weekend with him. Thank God that's not who I am today. So we finally parted company because I was going into the military. And when I first came into program, I really had a lot of anger against God. But to look back on now, he really saved me I don't know how many times. Now, I went to Vietnam. I was in Vietnam a year. And everybody just takes a go, oh, my God. Let me tell you, when I was in Vietnam, I was a food inspector. The only thing I got is kind of chubby. Didn't have to shoot anybody. Wasn't in the direct line of fire for anywhere. I was on Long Binh, which at that time was the largest military installation in the world. If I wanted a T-bone steak, we just went into the where they were stored, picked out your steak, came and fried it up. We really had it very easy. In fact, I took courses through the University of Maryland and got 12 units of my college education when I was in Vietnam. Now in Vietnam, all the stories you've heard is true. All my buddies either went out and got drunk every night or were loaded on either weed or whatever else was out there most of the time. So I'm not doing this. I was raised with that kind of crap. So I went to school instead. Good experience. It really, truly was a good experience. Got out of the military, met my first wife. Lovely lady, just like my mother, except she wasn't promiscuous and she didn't drink, but she had some severe psychological problems. Now, I heard a speaker speak last night, and he says, if you get 10 women up against the wall, I'd pick the sickest one. Well, make mine 500, and then I would pick the sickest one. And I always picked people that were so empty that you couldn't give enough 24 hours a day to fill the hole that they had. And that was my job to make them okay. Again, it never dawned on me what my needs were. My need was only what you needed. That would fulfill me. Well, we got married and had two daughters, which I adored. She had told me, I want to get married, but I don't want any children. And I'm not the real macho type, but I said, you know, this is what we're going to do. I want kids. I want two of them. And if you don't want to do that, it's a deal breaker. So she had the two children. It set off every part of her that it could. And she was not there for the kids. At that particular time, I worked. If she didn't want to work, that was okay. If she didn't want to clean the house, that was okay. I'd do that. If she didn't want to take care of the kids, I'd do that. It didn't make any difference. I'd step up and do whatever needed to be done. We were living out in San Bernardino. We had a beautiful home, furnished. People would walk in and say, this is like Better Homes and Gardens. I had a great job. I had completed my college degree. I had I was a human resource manager with a fairly large company. Everything should have been okay. And I was miserable. And I didn't know why, but because of the craziness that I had been raised in, I at least knew that somehow or another that had to have impacted me. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I remember it again like today. This lady starts sharing and says, I've been married 3 times, all to alcoholics, and I'm engaged now to an alcoholic. And I said, this has got to be the dumbest woman that God ever put on this earth. But something told me that I needed to be there and that I related to the craziness. I was in program about a year, and it really started unraveling. My ex-wife would do everything in the world to prevent me from going to a meeting because she knew long before I did where it was going to lead to. And she knew it would lead me to leaving her. Well, again, this program has taught me rigorous honesty, even if it's not a real pretty story. Well, I was very passive. The only way I can get along with her is just keep my mouth shut. I was a doormat. I was passive. I never stood up for myself. Well, in my case, I have a real problem with anger and rage, which builds up. So one day she was telling me to get out of the house, and I had these earphones on, and I was washing dishes. And for an hour and a half, she screamed at the top of her lungs, "Get out." And then she came in and knocked the earphones off my head. Not a good move. Because I came around, and I just swung. Well, I probably glanced off of her. I don't think I hit her. And I hit my refrigerator full on and broke my hand. Well, she realized that this is not a real safe position to be in. So she went and grabbed both my kids, one on each side. And I was slapping her. And my oldest daughter is yelling, "Dad, Dad, Dad," and I came out of it. I don't know about other people, but I've had it happen 3 times, and I've had what they call rage reactions. I can tell you what led up to it. I can tell you what happened when I came out of it. I cannot tell you the in-between part of it, because I don't know. To this day, I don't know what happened. So I knew, okay, I'm not living like this. This is just like my parents. I'm getting out. I left. We got back together for another year, and I finally left the marriage. And in that whole 12 years we were together, I was one of those, well, if it doesn't get better in a week, I'm leaving. 12 years later, I'm still there. And it's the strangest thing. When you're ready to do what you need to do. And it was the same old thing. We hadn't even gotten a fight. But I was so shut down, the only way you could get to me is to start picking on my oldest daughter. And then I would come in to protect her. Well, that dynamic started that morning. I was in the bathroom shaving. I looked in the mirror and said, "I'm a loving child of God, and I did not get put on this earth to live like this or to treat another human being like I was treating her." I said, "That's it." Walked out, said, "I'm leaving you," got a coat, and walked out the door. That's when we went into the war years, and it was really ugly. Because basically what my ex-wife said is, "Not only will I kill myself, I will kill both of these children, and you will regret the day that you ever left me." She meant it. She was capable of it, and I was terrified. But I had reached a point in program to say, "I'm not living this way anymore." I had been in a meeting, and there was a lady that was married to a police officer, and he used to beat the hell out of her. She left him. She was spending all night in all-night cafes so that he couldn't get her. And she came to a meeting and says, "I've never been so happy in my life." I walked up to that lady and said, "What the hell are you talking about?" She says, "It's time to get me back. I am not going to be treated like that. I'm not going to live like that." And I could not get that out of my mind. She was one of my Eskimos, those people that are put in your life for you to learn a lesson from. And I left thereafter. And it was very ugly. She really wasn't emotionally able to care for the 2 kids, so I had them about 85% of the time anyway. And then the money that I spent on divorce lawyers and going to court and all of it, I had to be a rich man, or richer today if I hadn't went through all that. but we all do what we have to do. And so let's just say it was an ugly time, very stressful. At one point, my two little girls, who I absolutely adored, changed schools 3 times and 5 different babysitters in the course of 3 months because of all the stuff that she was doing. Because schools would just say, we're not going to deal with her. Your kids are out of here. I almost broke that time. That's the closest I came to giving up. And I remember, and I'm not a crier. I mean, you don't see that in me. And I remember I started crying, and I had both daughters on both sides of me saying, Dad, it's going to be okay. Dad, it's going to be okay. Dad, it's going to be okay. And they're little. I mean, they're not older kids. I says, okay, then we got to just keep the fight up. And they said, yeah, we'll just keep going. Well, I'd been in program about 2 years, and I started having panic attacks. And what happened to me is, in order to survive, I shut down everything. I had no feelings. I could see somebody murdered in front of me and not blink, because it was so violent in my household, and it got so ugly of the household I was raised in. And I'm going, what it felt like is, it felt like a volcano that finally had the cap taken off and all this stuff comes out and you can't control it. And I don't know about anybody else, I'm a control freak. So when you can't even know what you're feeling from minute to minute, it doesn't give you a lot of security. And 1 minute I would be a 60-year-old man in a rocking chair because nobody could possibly love me because I was so messed up. And then I would be that child at 4 years old that was molested by my grandfather. And it was like, talking about feeling like you're nuts and that all these people are inside you and all screaming for attention at the same time. And I went on medication for a while until I realized what I was feeling was feelings that normal people feel. They were so far removed from me, I didn't even know what they were. The only feeling I had is not a feeling. It's anger. And anger is a cover-up for all the other stuff below it. But that is the only thing that I knew. And I'm really cleaning this up because there's children in the room. In my household growing up, I could go and tell my parents that they were a no good mother. That would have been acceptable behavior. For me to say, I am really hurting, I need you to hold me, would have been blasphemy. My father already had been calling me a faggot for I don't know how many years, and every other name that he could possibly come up with. That was not acceptable to show your feelings. You needed to be concentrated on the alcoholic. Your feelings didn't matter at all. So this was just, thank God for program. And again, I realized that I was very, very, very angry with God. Because if he had let me get molested, and if he had let me be emotionally abused and went through the trials that I did, I had no earthly use for him or anyone else. I was taught, you better be resourceful, you better be able to take care of yourself. I remember going one time over to my mom and dad's house with my first wife. And my dad hadn't fixed something right for my mother, so she had this sandwich and she threw it against the wall and it kind of melted down the wall. And then they started fist to cuffing. Well, I needed to get into the kitchen, so as my mother's fist came this way, I walked through, and then as the other one came through, I finished the walk. Absolutely like it was nothing. And my ex-wife is going, oh my God, what are you crazy? You're going to get killed. I said, what? So tuned out that I didn't even realize that that was weird behavior. That was just one example. Let me catch up here. Now, in therapy, and once this whole divorce thing started, at one point, my wife was very suicidal, and I had a sponsor that was a therapist and worked with suicide prevention quite a bit, and she said, do not, under any circumstances, return your daughters to her at this time. Every red light knowing the man is going on, and she could do exactly what she said she was going to do. I ran for 3 days. I could not go to work because I would have been arrested. I went and stayed at the sponsor's house. Thank God at that time they didn't have Amber Alert because they'd have caught me. I went to 4 different attorneys saying, you know, what can I do? They said, unless there's gaping wounds on your children that you can prove are recent and she did them, you must return those children to her. And they talk about in program when you give up and turn it over to God, what miracles happen. I really got a dose of that. Both girls were in therapy at the time. And I didn't know what to do. And I said, okay, I'm going to take them over. And the police were after me and saying, you're going to be arrested. So I took them over to the therapist and said, we'll call the police and then I've got to get out of here or they're going to arrest me. Now, at that point, my youngest daughter, who's a lot like me, very stoic, didn't let things out much, and I'm getting ready to go, and she just breaks down sobbing and says, Dad, what's going to happen? I said, babe, I don't know. I do not know, but I got to get out of here because they're going to come and arrest me if I don't get out of here. And they came and picked up the kids, and I called the deputy who had been set out to arrest me, and he said, you don't have to worry about it. You're not going to be arrested. Your kids thumped me, worked me over, and told me what was going on. And their mother demanded to come and see them at the police station. They said, the only way we will do that is if she's on one side of the petition and we're on the other. We're not on the same side. Just make sure she's away from us. Well, then we got put into the legal system. And that's a hard system to get out of. And we were each assigned an attorney, each one of the girls and me and my ex-wife. And something that I had never been able to get enough money up for was to have us all psychologically evaluated. Well, the court said, technically this is a legal matter because we'd already been divorced and we had all the parameters set out for the settlement. They said, but it's too volatile, we'll keep them in the system. But we shouldn't, but we will. We're gonna have you all psychologically evaluated. And you don't pay a penny. Then we got a female judge, and we went in front of that judge in the course of 3 years, 3 separate times. And my ex-wife went in there and told her, I don't give up what you do with this, and walked out. First time she did it, I said, well, done deal. And they said, nope, she was upset. Okay. And I knew if I got upset, then they could be horrible things could happen, so I kept my cool. A year later, did exactly the same thing, and the court said, whatever, she was upset. A year later, she did it a third time, judge said, sold. The kids are 100% yours. There's no visitation other than what you wish to do, period. And I basically raised my daughters for 15 years by myself. And I found out it was a whole lot easier to raise 2 children by yourself than to raise 3 and one was crazy. Just, it really did work out well. And I'm here to tell you that I couldn't be more proud of those two girls that are 29, somewhere around there. I'm old. I can barely remember my own name. They're both good human beings, but they've got their scars. And in all my arrogance, I wanted to say, well, I've done all this recovery work. You know what? My 26 years doesn't change the hundreds of years of alcoholism and sexual abuse that went on in my family history. They are scarred, as all of our children are scarred, by the lovely gift of alcoholism, which keeps giving and giving and giving. But we have a wonderful relationship today. Now in all of this, I want to throw something else in, because a lot of people criticize other programs, and I was really bad about doing that for a number of years. Well, in the big book, it says to use every source that's available to you, and they encourage that. Psychiatry, psychologist, whatever opens itself. I was an adult children for alcoholic program for a lot of years. It did me a lot of good. I was a very damaged child. And another gift that was given to me, there's an AA speaker named Bobby Earle, who's very much a rebel. I'm very much a rebel. I can't imagine why I would have connected to him. But when I was in meetings years ago, when people would talk about molestation or incest, I would go nuts. I mean, my reaction level was probably 10 times more intense than anyone else in the room. And people would be going, you know, it's a horrible thing, but why are you so upset about it? In a Bobby Earle tape, he's on a plane, and this little boy next to him is talking about how he's abused and how he's beat by his father. And Bobby Earle says, I just went bananas. And every time I heard about that, well, that's when he first discovered that he had been abused by his parents. And boy, I heard that. And I was in my mid-30s when the incest came up. And I had to deal with that. And incest is a really nasty little critter. And you blame yourself. There must have been something wrong with me that caused me to be the victim. It wasn't their fault, it was my fault. Well, I was 4 years old, and I'm telling you, no four-year-old makes that kind of choice. But thank God I was able to, that was able to come to the surface. And it came to the surface when I had a foundation group that gave me the support and the encouragement and the love that I needed that I couldn't get myself. And they were there. And they walked me through a lot of that. I went to another program, incest survivors. And you hear some really, mine was, you know, and it's, we like to compare ours to others. Mine was horrible. And I said, oh, but it wasn't as bad as theirs. It doesn't make any difference. It was bad and it very negatively impacted me. And in the course of a program, the first lady that I dated after I got a divorce was packaged a little differently, but she was still pretty damaged and an incest survivor. In fact, I've discovered in looking back on it now, of all the women I've ever dated, I've only dated one woman that wasn't an incest survivor. There was just a magnet. We're attracted to certain people for a reason, and our comfort zones and all of that stuff. Well, what my sponsor directed me to do at that time was, when you saw a woman that you were attracted to, go out the back door. Do not go to that woman. You need to become healthy enough you make better choices. And I was dating this one lady, and one of her best friends came up and said, you know, she is what she is, And what you really need is somebody to pat you on the head, tell you that it's going to be okay when you get home from work, and take care of you. And I said, you're totally crazy. Again, people see in us things that we can't see in ourselves, and that's exactly what I needed. And I met somebody that was a very loving spirit. And she had her own set of problems. We met through program. And we started dating. We started dating about a week before I was on the run from the law with the kids. And she told me, you know, I date a lot of guys that had kids, and they always told me how horrible the divorce was. And they always overset it. You underset it. I've never seen anything like this. But we dated for 7 years, and I was so broken that I could only let people get so close to me, and that was it. You could not get an inch closer, I don't care who you were, because it wasn't safe. And I couldn't let down the brick walls that I had put up. So we dated 7 years, and we both knew we had reached a wall that was insurmountable at that particular place and time, and we broke up. That was exactly the time I went back to Al-Anon and started in a men's group. Because no offense to anybody, but the people that trigger me to this day are the real dominant, strong, pushy women. And there's one or two in Al-Anon. And they really trigger me, and it's like I'm that ornery kid that goes, come on, let's do it. And so I went to a men's Al-Anon group. And that was a heck of a journey. Because what I discovered is that I had rejected all men. My mother told me that all men are a-holes. Therefore, in order to be loved by her, I had to be different from them. Well, my anatomy dictates that I am a male. And it was a very hard rope, a road to walk. I was at a meeting years ago, and I was the speaker, and I said, you know, I'm really grateful that I'm not a gay hooker on Sunset Boulevard with AIDS. A guy walked up to me and said, after that meeting, he says, you know, I was so angry when you said that. Because all those things, I am, and he had AIDS. And I said, I am not knocking anybody. I am not knocking anybody's root. I'm just glad I didn't have to go that way. Again, God delivers some very interesting message at different points in time. So, Don and I dated. We broke up. I went to Al-Anon. She went to her program. What I needed was to soften up, to be able to let somebody touch me, to learn that intimacy is a learned behavior. Intimacy is sitting on the couch with somebody holding hands. It has nothing to do with any sexual aspect. And let me tell you, intimacy is learned in your family. And if you had anything that I came from, that was the least thing that was there. I can tear somebody apart with words, but I could not put them together with love. That was a hard thing to realize, but since it's a learned behavior, you can unlearn what you learned and learn something new. And she had to learn to be hard, because I raised two daughters that are pretty strong ladies, and they did not want to share their father, and they made it very clear. So in order to survive with all of us, you had better be pretty tough and not easily or thin-skinned. So she had to get tougher. So we had broken up, and one of my daughters had graduated from high school, and we had just got into this huge fight, and I was about as angry as I could be. And Donna was there because she had got to know the girls and was close to them. And I started flirting with her. because I was so pissed. And we went out to dinner. She calls me the next day and said, you know, I'm going to ask you a weird question. Do you think there's a possibility we can get back together again? She says, you know what? I'm going to give you a weird answer. I said, yes, but we have to find out. Because we didn't know what our journeys had been in that 3 years. We got back together. And it was so funny. At first, I was sitting there watching some program. I'm crying, and she's not shedding a tear. I'm going, this is too weird. This is just not our regular dynamic. And we got married 3 years later. And one of the places that I love in the world is Sedona, Arizona. Well, I'd taken her to Sedona to propose. Well, I got lost, which is not terribly unusual. And the place I thought was where I wanted to go was wrong spot. So I thought, well, let's find another spot. And there's a airport, small airport in Sedona that looks over the entire city, and you can see all the lights. I thought, well, that'd be beautiful. So I had bought her this music box and put all this graffiti in it so you couldn't tell what was in there. And I handed it to her. Well, she didn't have her glasses on, and she's going, I don't know what's in there. And she didn't want to be embarrassed to say, oh my God, it's a ring, because if it wasn't, she'd have known, whatever. So I opened it up and I proposed to her. Well, the next night, we had a little extra time, and we had went out on a adventure, so to speak, of the sights of Sedona and the spirituality of Sedona with an Indian guide. And he said, well, we got a little extra time. Would you like to see some of the night locations? He drove exactly to the spot that I had proposed the night before. And we both get this weird look on our face. And he says, well, what's wrong? He says, well, I just proposed to her right here last night. He says, how would you like me to bless your union? And he had sage with him, and he went out, and we did an Indian ceremony, and he blessed the union. Now, I would love to tell you that that was just the smoothest transaction that ever happened. It didn't work that way. Donna had two daughters. I had two daughters. Donna raised her children by herself. I raised my children by herself. We're very protective of our children. And if you want to get blended families, the best thing that tears them up is children. It just is a ripper. Because you're protecting yours, they're protecting theirs. Oh, it was bad. And then we moved into the house that I had bought, which I had gotten. My daughters lived in, and Don had always said, you know, this isn't my turf. In fact, funny story. I love to decorate. And when I decorate, every square inch of every wall is full. So my house was just like I wanted it. Well, she had this whole lifetime of stuff. I says, well, can't you store it someplace? And she says, and you won't make a wall for me to put my stuff up? Well, that had went on a while, and she came home one day from a meeting. Every wall in the house was stripped. And I says, go for it. It's all yours. Well, I didn't mean that. You're going to help me decorate. And I said, cold day in hell. You wanted the walls. You got them. Now, do I recommend that? And is that practical? And is that sensible? No, hell no. It's crazy. That finally got resolved. Now, I had, as a child, had horses, and it was really my love. Early on, I learned that people were not safe. Animals were. If you were in a room with four walls, you could capture me and something bad would happen. If I was outdoors, good luck catching me. And we had been married a while, and my wife says, and we went to visit a friend's, and they had just bought this place and had two stalls on it. Horse stalls. And she said, my face just absolutely lit up. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know what? You need to get involved in the horses again. You have no hobbies. You're a workaholic. But your face lights up when you see the horses. So I volunteered at a rescue where they rescue injured animals. And I ended up buying one of the horses. Well, in the meantime, the sponsor that I found in Al-Anon said, okay, do you want to buy a horse property? I said, oh, no, I'm too old. So we build this absolutely magnificent kitchen. By I say we build, he built, I was slave labor. But it's gorgeous, all oak. I mean, this thing was just so beautiful. We did one other room, and I said, we're going to sell. He said, God damn it, I knew it. Every time I built a kitchen for somebody, the house sells within a year. He will not touch with the kitchen where we live now. He said, I'll do anything else, but you are not getting a kitchen here. So anyway, I decided I want to try to see if I can afford and buy horse property. And that was an interesting journey. Well, just about that time, my mother passed away. And some dynamics between me and my mom. I had to really work hard at distancing the two of us. Because if it was up to her, I would be her every Saturday night date. I would be her significant other. I knew that was very destructive for me, and I couldn't do that. Now, at one point, we had taken her to Sedona on a trip with us, and we were having lunch, and she tells Donna, you know, the only time I would have ever remarried is if I found somebody just like Jack. I freaked out. What I had imagined all these years was very true. When I went to Vietnam, from the day I left to the time I got back, my mother put on 100 pounds. So was there a connection between us? Oh, just a little one. Mm-hmm. And at her funeral, I wouldn't go in to view the body. I can't do that. And I couldn't, and I didn't. Well, I had a friend that was in program that was a priest, and he was going to do the ceremony. Well, it's in Forest, up in Forest Hill Lawn, up in Whittier, and we're on a slope. Some of my uncles are in their 80s and 90s. I think, oh, God, I'm going to kill off an uncle if I don't get this thing moving. It was 3 o'clock. It was due to start at 3. He didn't show. By the time 3:30 came, I looked at my oldest daughter and says, have you ever done a funeral before? She says, no. Well, I said, we're going to now. And we did it. I couldn't talk all the time because I was crying. But she's a very eloquent speaker. And just, I wish I had taped it. It was the most beautiful statement about my mother. Because she said, you know what? Grams wasn't one of those cookie cutter grandmas. But she taught me how to be a strong woman and to stick up for yourself. And she was there for me. And I wish I'd had it taped because it was so beautiful. And we had a funeral. And just as everybody was leaving, the priest showed up. And I said, and he said, well, the church got broken into. I couldn't come until I talked to the police. I said, that's all right. My mother arranged all this. Mm-hmm. She'd have rolled over in her grave if she knew a priest was at her funeral. I said, hey, I don't want no damn priest. So I said, she arranged all this anyway, so not a problem. So just shortly after that, we found a property, and it was actually the fourth house that we had put money down. And it is absolutely a touch of heaven. It's a half an acre in Montclair. It's horse property. Each one of the properties are a half an acre and then back up to a trail. So we have 6 miles of trail that you can take the horses out just outside your gate. And you can be in my kitchen and watch the horses in the backyard. And we've got chickens and ducks and all kinds of stuff. And this is a gift of this program. I would have never had the courage to say, I'm approaching retirement, but I want to do this. And my wife was so encouraging and says, you've got to do this. We're going to do this. And we bought this house. So it prolonged a little of our retirement because we're still going to be paying for that house. But it's exactly what we want. It's not pretentious. It's not a mansion. It's a nice house we built, me and my sponsor and some other friends, built a barn. It's beautiful. It's just, I'm in paradise. And in the evening, I'll be out there. And they talk about stopping to smell the roses. I never understood that. And I will be out there, and it will be this beautiful sunset with all these pinks and oranges and golds. And I set myself down in a chair, and I watch that sunset go down until it gets dark. And I'm in seventh heaven. I could not be happier. And my wife goes, well, God, I never thought I was going to be a farmer's wife. She's out there before I am in the morning feeding the ducks. And she's a very nurturing, loving person. And each animal has its little goodies. And each one gets its favorite little things every single morning. Now, when she's gone for a weekend, it's like, hey, you get the basics. She's not here. She'll give you it when she gets back. I love the place. And it's funny. When I went to Al-Anon, I returned to Al-Anon, I really needed a sponsor. I was in another program. No one else was in that program longer than me, and everybody was looking for me for direction. And I was drowning. And I went to this meeting because it had been there for 35 years, and I knew it had good recovery. So I went there to find a sponsor, and I did. Now, our birthdays are about 8 days apart. We're both stubborn, stubborn Tauruses. He's the best friend I've ever had. He's been there for me thick and thin. Now, he just started renting a place a couple months ago, about a mile from my house, with an acre. And I went on a trip one to Alaska. He came back and he pulls me outside and says, I got to talk to you. So, okay, what's going on? I had bought a mare and she had a colt, and the colt was ready to be sold. He says, I want that colt. I said, no. It's the worst thing for an inexperienced person to get into horses with a colt. Damn, you don't know nothing. They don't know nothing. It's just not a good combo. He says, no, you don't understand me. I want him. I said, okay, he's yours. The colt is now going on 2.5, and he's going to start breaking the colt shortly. This is a man that lived his whole life helping others. Never knew what his needs were, didn't worry about those needs. Now it's funny, he's got a cowboy attitude. And we won't go into great details what words that is, but he's got a cowboy attitude. He's lost 100 pounds so that he can ride that colt and start working with him. He has a life that he talks about all the time as just being awesome. And the first project we ever did together, I would have never been able to accept that from another human being. And we have built kitchens. We have built barns together. And we're closer than any family member I could have ever had. He was my best man at my wedding. When I got married the second time, we had 200 people. 85% of them were program people. We didn't invite one single person that we thought didn't have our best interests at heart. It was an incredible, incredible day. Our four daughters were the bridesmaids. I just can't even say enough. We accepted help. When somebody says, well, let me bring something. Okay, that's a great gift. They would bring something. We let people there be there for us. It was absolutely a tremendous experience. Now, I want to hit on some things that I think are really important in program. Because I've talked about all this recovery and the gifts that it's given me. But bottom line, it's called the 12 steps for a reason. And I've seen so many people come and go in the course of 26 years. And it's really nice to find a place that you blend with and you fit with. And you get to talk feelings. And you get to make some connections. But what I've seen and experienced is if somebody doesn't do the 12 steps, it starts not working and they leave. And to me, what I've seen is a 4-step is the deal breaker. If somebody does the fourth step, goes on to the fifth steps, they will stay and the miracle happens. And they used to have a saying years ago, stay until the miracle happens for you. And I'm so competitive, it's like, I'm not about to leave a day before it happens for me. Hell no. So I stayed, and I've had many miracles that I could sit and talk about all day long. Making calls. It took me 2 years in program to make my first call. Because, of course, well, it's 5 o'clock. You just got home from dinner, from work, so you have to have dinner. Well, you have to clean up. Then you have to help the kids with whatever. That's 10 o'clock. It's way too late to call. I did that for 2 years. And I know a lot of people have done the same thing. And I have to tell everybody that ever calls me, whatever you think you get out of this call, I get out a whole lot more. Reminds me of where I came from. It keeps the program alive. The 12 steps says you will give away what you have received. That's the beauty of this program. It's that continuing circle of love. If you're in your bedroom and you're isolating and you're not talking to anybody, what are you stuck with? Your head. And I don't know about any of you, that is a spooky place for me to spend the time. And I don't want to be there. So I get so much more. Sponsorship. I can't say enough about, I was born and raised that you have to take care of yourself. You never, ever, ever ask for help. I have learned in program that no matter what you're going through or how bad it gets, all you have to do is reach for a telephone. And I had times when my ex-wife would be with the kids for the weekend, and it was 2 hours past. And my head took off that, oh my God, they're dead. And man, I'd get on that phone. And I wouldn't get the first person, I'd get the ninth person. And the ninth person is who I needed to speak to at that particular time. And they helped me through until those kids came back and I knew they were safe. There is nothing in this world that I need to do by myself. My sponsor's available, that's wonderful. My sponsor's not available, there's a phone list. Call somebody. And I am not intruding on anybody. I'm helping them with their recovery, as when people call me, I'm helping with their recovery. To me, the 12 steps come alive when you give it away. You must give it away. It's a tremendous element. Now, I want to share again, I had started talking about it before, about the different journeys that we can take in our recovery. And mine again was through grief recovery. I could never forgive. I don't care how many years in program, because I felt that if I forgive my grandfather who molested me, I was saying it was okay. And damn sure that was never going to happen. And in grief recovery, I was at a meeting with Bobby Earle. He was a speaker. And somebody walked up to him that was close by me and said, how do you get over grief recovery? He says, you walk over to that little table over there. There's a book by John James. You start working that book. I said, okay. And the lady that he had told it to, I said, you want to work on it? Well, she was really hurting lady, and she was never able to do that. So I walked into a meeting one day, and I walked up to three friends and said, guess what we get to do? I said, I don't want to do that, but because you mean so much to us, we will do it. And we worked through the first part of the grief recovery, and I've done it on several. And you at the end, you focus on one individual. And I've done that like 8 different times on primary people in my life. One of the elements that I got out of that was that what you do is you forgive the fallible human being. You don't forgive the act. When a child is molested, that's an unforgivable act, period. But you can forgive the fallible human being that did it. And I was able to do that. And my family, my father's family, he came from a family of 10. It's a very large extended family. And my mother, in order to be on her side, I had to give up that whole family. And then as I got into recovery, I said, that's your battle. I'm going to reconnect with my dad's family. There are about four people in it with anorexia and various other diseases, and those are very often connected with sexual abuse. Nobody has to tell me that my grandfather only got to me. They don't do it that way. And I went up to an aunt that I had not seen in 15 years and said, and I knew she was probably the safest, said, I need to talk to you. Can we go off to the side and talk? And I said, I don't even know how to start on this. And she said, I was molested by your father. She burst into tears. She had been molested by an uncle that lived next door that had also molested me. She had only told one other person, in her 60s, had never told anybody. And it's funny, this other cousin was doing, in psychology, was doing a kind of a project on the family, and I told her, whoever you want to tell is fine with me. Because as long as I keep the secret, I allow it to happen. I'll be damned. The truth is going to be known. Let it chips fall where they may. And she was on the phone with another cousin, and the cousin overheard the conversation. Well, I get a call about a week later from this cousin and said, I'm working on these issues. Is there any reason why you would expect my father of anything? It's one thing, my memories didn't come up until both parties were dead, which is really, really common, by the way. And I said, I got to tell you my reality, and it's only mine. Yes, I believe your father molested me, as well as my grandfather. And she got into some work and discovered, yes, her father had molested her. And I don't care who knows about it. When they talk about AA and the graveyard list, where you list things that you're so ashamed of that you want to go to your grave with nobody ever finding out, I'll tell you what. Other than it hurting my family, I would publish that graveyard list in the LA Times because it has no power. The truth will set you free, and it set me free. That was their disease. That was their illness. I didn't cause it. Now, where I am today, and God to me has a sense of humor. I believe in karma. Whatever you put into the world, you're going to get back. And God is always putting people in my path for me to learn lessons from. That's how he works it. And I've always had a problem with detachment. I remember reading it in the Blue Book, One Day at a Time. I read it and I still didn't understand what it said, and I'm not a stupid person. But it was such a foreign concept to me to detach from other people, because that was my job. I mean, that's what I needed to do. So I still struggle with detachment. And again, his sense of humor. I've been going through a really, really rough patch recently. And some depression, and I'm in the process of changing some medication due to the depression. And I'm going, oh God, I get to speak and I'm totally a wreck. And you know, I know enough that God says, I need you to speak, and you're my vessel, and whatever you need to say will be said. And it's in his power. My sponsors often told me that if you got into program, and you made a deal or a pact that if I stay in program, this is what I want to get back. I'm here to tell you, we would all shortchange ourselves 100 times over, because our self-esteem is not high enough to say, give me the whole enchilada. I'll just take the refried beans in the corner that have been eaten by somebody else. It's like, no, you deserve the whole enchilada. But what I also learned is I can take that much bad, and I'm used to that, and that's not a problem. But you give me that much good, and it freaks me out, because I think you only get that much good in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. So you're using up all the good stuff. So I've learned there is an abundance of good once you allow it to come in, and you deserve it. We all deserve it. Now, the most recent, and this blew my mind, and it just happened just recently, and I pre-warned my daughter that I was going to bring it up. She was having a conversation with her mom, and she told me about it. She says, yeah, Mom, you and Dad were really lousy parents. And I always thought I was just spectacular. And a hell of a lot better than anything that I had gotten. And then I said, well, you know, that kind of hurts my feelings. And she says, no, you need to know where I'm coming from. She says, you were so both so busy fighting your demons that you weren't available. And my ism played out in workaholism. Okay. It played out in workaholism, and I was gone. Well, why? Whatever reason you're gone from your children, you're still not there. If it's drinking, if it's drugs, if it's work, if it's other people, you're not there. So, and one of the real things I always had a problem with is when I was in a meeting and they said, and your parents did the best they could. You want something to fire me up? I would go ballistic on that one. Well, let me tell you, the best they did sucked. And I got the bad end of the stick. You know, when my daughter told me that, I finally, 26 years later, understand they did the best they could. The only other thing I'll add is she said, you know what, but you've made up for it. Mm-hmm. You two are both incredible grandparents. And one of my living amends to my children is when they want me or they request my time, I make myself available for them. And when they want me to watch the grandkids, not a problem. Because you know that little kid in me loves to play pirates with my grandsons. And I make a tremendous ghost. And I am on the ground playing with them, and I have a wonderful time. We have a little plaque in our house that says, your grandchildren are your gift for not having killed your teenagers. And I'm here to tell you that's true. Because there were some times that they were real lucky that they didn't go down that path. I have a wonderful, wonderful, awesome life today. And one of the biggest changes, I have so much more of a positive attitude. Because at one point I remember I said, I have so many issues and I am so screwed up. If I live three lifetimes, it's not enough time to clean this all up. It happens. In God's time, it happens. And I've got an awesome life today with wonderful people. And I'll end it with just a chuckle. I've got horses. I've got a grandson out here that I wanted to trailer the horses out to go riding. But I don't know where to go riding. So who should I meet this weekend? One lady has a horse ranch, and the other one, her daughter, has horses and says, bring them out. We'll go ride in them. There's all kinds of areas to ride in. That's a God thing. God gives me all these incredible gifts if I'm receptive and I'm open to them, and I am through the grace of the 12 steps. And my family here, because I'd like to also say my family got all kinds of recovery. My mother and father both died alcoholics, and the only reason they weren't drinking is because of medical problems. I've got three of the craziest brothers you could ever want to meet, and the disease is playing out as it will in all of them. But I don't have to let it destroy my life. I have parameters, I have guidelines, I can set boundaries, and I can become the best Jack I can be instead of what was projected that I should be. And it's an awesome, incredible journey. The only thing is, on occasion, fasten your seatbelt because it could get bumpy. Thank you for letting me share.